This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
Hey Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around for a quick breakdown of some of the biggest headlines later in the episode. But first, we are near the end of a political era in Illinois. Senator Dick Durbin's long run is coming to a close, and right now a heated Democratic primary will decide who will take his place. Among the leading candidates, Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy. He's built a reputation in Washington over the course of a decade on oversight, national security, and consumer protection. But in this moment, when many Illinoisans are faced with economic pressures and fear from a global conflict, what is the case he's making to voters? With primary day fast approaching, we're talking with the major contenders about the priorities they'd bring to the U.S. Senate and how they plan to stand out in the crowded field. You've heard from Congresswoman Robin Kelly and Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. And in this episode, my one-on-one with Raja Krishnamoorthy. While his schedule didn't allow for an in-person interview, Krishnamoorthy squeezed in a phone call with me from Washington in between votes and intelligence hearings. And that's where the interview started. We discussed his busy agenda.
It has been tremendously hectic. And I think that right now, unfortunately, in Washington, D.C., there's no shortage of tasks that need to be performed to hold the Trump administration accountable because I believe they're acting with impunity. They're acting recklessly, and now with Iran, dangerously. And there, I've also taken a special kind of role because of my assignment on the Intelligence Committee as well.
Yeah. Tell me more about that, because you've been in and out of intelligence briefings. Has the administration, to you, made the case yet for war?
Absolutely not. And the briefings have been unsatisfactory. They haven't answered some fundamental questions that I believe the American people want answered. And as a consequence, I think that it's imperative that we end these hostilities. Look, I understand that the Iranian regime must not be allowed to have a nuclear weapon, but the best way to do that is through diplomacy in concert with our friends, partners, allies, and others. And right now, if that is the objective of this particular war, it has not been achieved. It will not be achieved because even the administration concedes that although they said that they had, quote unquote, obliterated the nuclear weapons program last summer, it still exists and it can't be ended except through some kind of ground assault. And the American people don't want another endless war and troops on the ground. And they just, they absolutely do not want a war in the Middle East. And I agree 200% with them.
Well, tell me more about like where you draw the line. When is a war necessary? Under what circumstances would an attack on another foreign power be an appropriate step to take?
Well, look, I think that the president should have the right to defend America and the United States, especially from an imminent threat. And so if that imminent threat exists, then I think that he or she should be able to exercise that right. However, if that is not the case, then the president must come to the people through their elected representatives in Congress and ask for the people's consent. And the reason why we have that, in addition to the fact that the Constitution mandates it, in addition to the fact that the War Powers Act of 1973 also makes it law, is because the president and the executive branch needs to answer critical questions that the American people have about any type of military action. What is the objective? What is the duration? What is the end game? What are the costs, not just in terms of treasure, but also lives? And this president doesn't have an answer to any of those questions. I know because I listened to these briefings, and I'm going to be going into another 2-hour classified briefing tomorrow. And unfortunately, they just don't know what they're doing. And I'm very concerned that we're kind of in this endless war situation once again.
Well, WBEZ conducted a survey of Illinois voters. We were asking them what issues mattered to them this election season. Here's one question from a voter. They said, America's standing abroad has taken a hit, whether due to disrespecting foreign sovereignty, our tariff policy, or withdrawing from treaties. Are you worried, Congressman, about our global partners turning on us? And what will you do to help strengthen our bonds abroad?
I am concerned about that. And I think that when we kind of shun our friends, partners, and allies, and we draw closer to our adversaries, I believe that we show weakness. And when you show weakness, you invite aggression by your adversaries. And that aggression could lead to conflict and, God forbid, war. And that's what history has shown over and over again. And that's what I fear our current foreign policy is inviting, that we're sliding toward conflict and worse in different parts of the world. And so what I believe very strongly is that we should be drawing closer to our friends, partners, and allies to try to curb aggression by our adversaries in economics, but also in security matters and technological matters as well. And when you do so, you start to establish what I call the international rules of the road. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, don't invade, you know, neighboring countries to try to redraw borders. Cooperate on areas where there can be win-win, such as, for instance, in combating climate change or working together on economic development. These are all or working together to stem a global pandemic and prevent them for the future. Mm-hmm. These are all important activities that, unfortunately, we've kind of walked away from at this point in the Trump administration, making us less safer as a country.
Another issue that came up again and again from local voters in the survey is political polarization in this country. And you've seen that polarization in the House. So I'm wondering how you would navigate working across the aisle in the Senate.
Well, first of all, we have to stand for principle. And that means, of course, holding the Trump administration accountable for its abuse of power, its illegal acts, indeed its unconstitutional behavior in a lot of cases, especially with ICE and CBP. And that's in part why I've called for abolishing Trump's ICE. However, where there can be agreement, especially on matters of, for instance, pocketbook issues, which a lot of our constituents are very concerned about, we should try to work together to address them. So, for instance, I authored the law that modernizes our nation's skills-based career technical and vocational education system. Mm-hmm. And I worked on this with Republicans. It helps 13 million people annually get a higher quality skills-based education now compared to before. And that's very important for the 64% of Americans without a four-year college degree. And this particular piece of legislation, which became law, has been wildly successful, but terribly underfunded, Sasha Ann. And so this is an area where I believe I can work with Republicans and others and try to fully fund what I think is an important priority, which is making sure everyone has a good world-class post-secondary education so they can get access to what I call the greatest social welfare program devised by human beings, and that's a J-O-B.
The Democratic Party has, you know, for some years now been in the midst of an identity crisis to the point where a lot of voters say that they don't know what the party stands for. What does the party stand for to you?
To me, it is the party of economic opportunity. It's the party that enable somebody, whether they're working poor, middle class, or growing a business, to realize their American dream, however they define it. And right now, more than ever, people feel economically distressed. I can't tell you how many people tell me, hey, I don't know if I'll ever be able to afford a home. I don't know how to afford childcare, healthcare, or educating my kids, or even retirement. And so we have to be the party that leans in on these particular areas, offers ideas, works with others to try to come up with ways that people can enjoy these staple milestones of being part of the middle class or enjoying their American dream. I think this is where we really need to spend a lot of time. And the second broad thing I would say is we should never accept the status quo. We've always got to be the ones trying to agitate for improvement in the lives of working people and in government as well. And so we want to make it more effective. We want to make it more efficient, and we want to make it more responsive and transparent. That's why I called for various measures to make fully transparent allegations against people for sexual harassment. That's why I have agitated on the Oversight Committee for full transparency on the Epstein files. I even voted to hold in contempt members of both parties who were not cooperating with the committee on this issue.
On the topic of affordability, I mean, talk more about the specific steps that you would take to improve that situation for Illinoisans in both the short term and long term. Because, I mean, it's not just housing, it's groceries, it's healthcare, and more that have gone up while wages are just staying where they are.
That's right. Well, I have something called the My American Dream Plan. I hope that people kind of check it out on my website. But essentially, what I talk about are some of the staple items that a lot of people think of when they think of realizing their American dream. So let's just take housing for 1 second. I've basically proposed a refundable tax credit worth upwards of 10% of the purchase price of your first home. This is not a new idea. It was actually an idea that was used in the Obama administration that put 2 to 3 million people in their first home in the midst of a horrible housing crisis right after the great financial crisis. It went away, and now it needs to come back because I think people right now, especially young people, feel like they don't have the money to pay for a 20% down payment for their first home. Another issue is we have to make sure that large corporate interests, special interests, are not able to stamp out competition, leading to higher prices, lower number of choices, and lower quality products and services. And unfortunately, we're seeing that across the landscape. There's way too much market consolidation and concentration of power. And we in the government have to police that and in some cases break it up. That's why I went after the Kroger Albertsons merger, successfully helping to prevent that because it would have led to higher prices and lower working conditions. And that's in part why, you know, the United Food and Commercial Workers endorsed me. I'll just touch on one last thing. And okay. I know there's so many, but I also, you know, I'm a product of food stamps and public housing. When my father lost his income in the 70s, thanks to the generosity of this country, we were allowed to move into those two programs. And we were able to then later on get on our feet and make it to the middle class. But that food insecurity that unfortunately many families feel has skyrocketed, especially now with cuts to SNAP. One program that I'm proposing is universal free lunch because childhood food insecurity is at an all-time high. And I, you know, some people say there should never be a free lunch. I think there should actually be a free lunch for children at school. And where you have universal free lunch, you see hunger go down, you see learning go up, and you see attendance go up.
Yeah, the current administration, I mean, they've used federal funding cuts as a pressure tool and a form of revenge to get cities and states in line with their Correct. Agenda. Chicago and Illinois, we know this really well. And so anything else you can state about your plans to get that funding back or just prevent further cuts at the federal level?
I think there are four things we have to do. One is we have to shine a light on the harm that's being done by these freezes and these particular funding cuts. I think that it's really important that people understand the real world consequences of what's happening, and it comes home to them in a much more understandable fashion than just talking about it in an abstract academic way. The second thing is we do have to pursue litigation. It does work, especially at the lower court level. And I think that just as we're trying to win support in the court of public opinion, as I mentioned a second ago, we also need to win in the legal courts. The third thing we have to do is pursue vigorous oversight in Congress. That means blocking appropriations, blocking nominees, you know, doing what I tried to do with Kristi Noem today, which is bringing people in to testify under oath before Congress, which they don't really like to do, but it holds their feet to the fire. And then the fourth thing is holding people accountable on the other side or any side who vote in favor of these policies that might hurt people.
Well, leave us with this, Congressman. What separates you from the others in this race? What should our listeners be left with today?
I think there are two big challenges that face us right now. One is those economic challenges that we talked about that are frustrating people's ability to realize their full potential, their American dream, as it were. And I've worked on these economic issues for almost a decade. And I feel as a former small business person, I'm best positioned to address those economic issues going forward, not just, you know, among Democrats, but with the other side as well. The second set of challenges that we have is that we have a government that is out of control right now. Mm-hmm. ICE and CBP are the best examples. And I've spent a decade in Congress standing up to bullies and bad actors, whether it's big tobacco, which fueled the vaping epidemic and caused Time magazine to say that I have a jewel-shaped target on my back, or whether it's food companies that poison our baby food with toxic heavy metals. I went after many industries, and using the different levers that we have in government, was able to craft regulation and laws on a bipartisan basis that for the first time address some of these ills. We need to do the same thing now. I need to stand up to the biggest bully of them all, Donald Trump. But we need to do so creatively. And it's not going to just be calling in names. It's going to have to require using our leverage to get things done and change the course of this country.
Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy of Illinois' 8th District, running for Senate to replace Dick Durbin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
Okay, now for a quick update on the biggest stories in our area. At the table to help me break it down, Claire Lane, WBEZ's Morning Edition anchor, and Michael Puente, a WBEZ reporter and weekend anchor. There was a crazy rainstorm across the region last night, so here's Claire with more on how that went.
Yes, what? It was indeed a very action-packed storm. Across the Chicago area, we saw, you know, most of the damage done, not in the metro area. Most of it, Mike will tell you about, in Kankakee County. Hail as large as 6 inches in diameter.
Wow.
Possibly breaking a state hailstone record for size.
I saw so many videos of cars damaged.
Those, right, the windshields with just the force of the hail and the size of the hail were cracking windshields. Various sizes, some pieces smaller than quarters, others as big as baseballs. WBEZ's Lisa Laba shared some video from Oak Park of hail that was sort of around the size of a pinball or a nickel size,
oh, wow. Okay.
But falling pretty furiously.
Mm-hmm.
National Weather Service says reports of some golf ball-sized hail received in Woodridge, Downers Grove, Darien, some of those Westmont areas, DuPage County. Also seeing a few power outages because of the storms last night.
Yeah, I heard some of the smaller pieces of hail on the south side of Chicago last night. But the downpour was undeniable. I had to run out and get something from my car. And I was like, okay, here we go. I got drenched. I was soaked in just seconds of being out there. So I can only imagine if you had to be out there for any stretch of time. But Mike, tell us more about the tornadoes. So Kankakee and Northwest Indiana too, right?
That's right. Right next to Kankakee is Newton County in Northwest Indiana. I'm about maybe 30, 40 minutes north of there. So you have
Well,
we were in the path of at least the rain and the heavy winds, not exactly the tornadoes. At least two people died, unfortunately, and a lot of people injured in a little town called Lake Village. It's right on the Kankakee River. I wouldn't call it Tornado Alley, but they really get it hard. If it's not tornadoes, it's flooding on the Kankakee. So they're dealing with a lot of widespread damage, a lot of homes damage. I mean, you could see from the radar just this divide between the cold weather, the cold air, and the warm air.
Right.
And there was huge differences in temperatures. And just in my area of Merrillville, the temperature went from about 45, 46, and like an hour later, spiked up to about 62. So you got just a push of warm air. Mm. And so that caused... They're just going to have a lot of cleanup, a lot of damage, and it's just really unfortunate. And right, the hail that I saw, it looked like a softball size with spikes. It looked like it came from Krypton or something like that.
Wow,
it's just crazy.
Yeah, and so I remember, you know, we had flash flooding warns and watches yesterday. The rain continues this morning, certainly on my drive into Navy Pier. Claire, what else is going on?
Yeah, there were flooded out lanes on Lakeshore Drive this morning, mostly that right lane, just because the sewage system can't drain it quickly enough, and people got to get to work. They've got to get their kids to school. Also seeing flooding on the west side of Chicago this morning. Rain is going to continue, Sasha, pretty much all day, off and on, so not much relief. Temperatures for us are going to remain in the upper 30s, could see about 40 downtown. But some areas, as Mike was mentioning, those temperatures are kind of going to plummet. So this could be more of everyone's favorite rain, snow, wintry mix toward the better part of the afternoon.
All right. In other news, Mike, a local law firm is pushing for an investigation of federal immigration officials who operated here in Chicago. Fill us in.
That's right, Sasha. Chicago law firm Lovey and Lovey is leading the charge, calling for a special prosecutor to investigate federal agents' use of force while conducting immigration enforcement last fall. The firm claims U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents committed assault and battery against peaceful civilians, members of the clergy, and even reporters. They even illegally kidnapped and detained an elected official and others. So they're calling for an independent special prosecutor to essentially ensure that there is accountability in Cook County. But there's a little pushback from Cook County State's Attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke. She says that, you know, a special prosecutor could actually make it more difficult to prosecute and convict federal agents accused of breaking the law. So, you know, this is still going to be playing out. But if you remember, Lovey and Lovey actually took DHS to court to stop a lot of the abuses against everybody, including reporters.
Now, the CTA is responding to complaints about violence on public transit, Claire. What action are they taking?
I actually saw this over the weekend. I was riding CTA quite a bit, and there are going to be more cops patrolling trains. We're seeing it now. CTA bringing in police from the Cook County Sheriff's Office to do this, and all part of the CTA's revised safety plan to meet the needs of the Federal Transit Administration. As we know, back in December, the FTA ordered the CTA to lay out a new plan for crime or risk losing up to $50 million in federal funding. But apparently, we're going to boost policing in the city by 75% to hopefully not lose that $50 million.
Mm-hmm. Anyone who has ever had to buy a concert ticket, Michael, they should pay attention to this next story. Yesterday, Live Nation, which owns Ticketmaster, announced that it had set aside nearly $300 million to settle claims against the company. So catch us up on what happened.
Sure. So Live Nation and Ticketmaster, you know, agreed to a settlement with the federal government over accusations that the ticket giant's business practices create a monopoly for live events, you know, in all across the nation. So the senior justice official said a briefing Monday that the agreement will give consumers more options and bring ticket prices down. However, the settlement avoided to break up Live Nation and Ticketmaster, which was a demand from some of the more than 30 states suing the company.
Mm, wow. There's a new development, and Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul is part of it.
He's saying that, you know, this agreement, he's going to reject it in other sort of Democratic-leaning states, that it just doesn't go far enough. And it looks like they were trying to get into this settlement to protect big businesses. So we'll see what happens with that, but they are pushing back that this is not a good settlement for consumers.
It is March, Claire, but the city is already looking ahead to the summer months.
That's, everybody is.
Right? Yes. Well, we got that fall spring the other day. We can't blame us.
We got a little sweet taste of that summer nectar. Yeah.
And then they reward us with this hail and tornadoes. But summer is also when young people are looking for summer jobs. So how is the city of Chicago gearing up for that?
Yes. And as we know, the Park District, one of the biggest employers for city youth. But they're doing a little rebrand, probably to try to attract some of the young talent. This is a new name and a new motto. So One Summer Chicago was launched back in 2011. It's now going to be known as Chicago Youth Works, and the motto is Get Paid, Get Skilled.
Wait, they're changing the name again?
They're changing the name again. Get Paid, Get Skilled, Get Ahead.
Ah, that's got a little ring to it.
See if you buy in. I mean, I think Get Paid is first, right?
Yes.
Teens love to have a little bit of cash during the summer months.
Oh, they sure do.
And the program, jobs program from Mayor Brandon Johnson bounced back from a little pandemic lull, but they want to just increase more kids getting jobs for the Park District and for the city.
Keep them busy.
Keep them busy. Keep them busy. Off the streets.
Yeah. What else are you looking out for?
This is kind of a big industry news story. We've seen a lot of Chicago breweries close in the last couple of years just due to sort of market saturation. Even in the last 6 weeks, 5 local breweries have either closed or announced that they're closing. But now Chicago's Half Acre, which is located on the north side, and Maplewood Breweries, which is on the northwest side in Logan, they're merging. So they're going to become one, what they're calling is a beverage company. These two craft breweries are yet to be named, but this is a pretty big move. They're saying it's not necessarily correlated to this market saturation, not showing any signs of struggling, but that they share similar visions for the future.
Mm. We'll leave it there. WBEZ's Claire Lane and Michael Puente.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Maha Ahmed, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.